All right, next up we're going to hear from Travis Groats, GI surgical oncologist from the Mayo Clinic, and he's going to be covering neutropenia and abdominal pain with a focus on neutropenic enterocolitis.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks, Marty. I have no disclosures. So over the next 10 minutes, real quickly, I'd like to just talk a little bit about the differential diagnosis of abdominal pain in a neutropenic patient, a little bit about what we understand about the pathogenesis, spend a little bit of time on incidence, clinical presentation, and diagnosis, but hopefully mostly spend our time talking about the management and outcomes for these patients. So the differential diagnosis can be quite broad in these patients, the most common it will be is neutropenic enterocolitis in about a third of the patients who are neutropenic and abdominal pain. But it can be stuff that we see in people who are non-neutropenic, such as C. diff, bowel obstruction, as we've heard earlier, cholecystitis, as we heard earlier. They also can have simple appendicitis, diverticulitis, and other things. There can be just from chemotherapy toxicity. It can cause abdominal pain, graft-versus-host disease. There can be multiple other things, liver abscesses. So the differential diagnosis is quite broad. So I'm going to spend most of my time on neutropenic enterocolitis, since that's what we haven't covered yet. And so it was originally described with the taxane chemotherapy agents. However, there's an increasing number of chemotherapy agents now associated with neutropenic enterocolitis, and really any medication or chemotherapy can cause that. It was also originally described in pediatric leukemic patients, but has increasingly been described, obviously, in adult hematologic patients, lymphoma, leukemias, myelodysplastic syndrome, HIV, AIDS patients, patients that are going therapy for solid tumors, and even organ transplant patients can have neutropenic enterocolitis. So the exact pathogenesis isn't exactly completely defined, but essentially what we believe is that the neutropenia causes impairment of the gut mucosal barrier, which then allows the microbes to translocate into the wall of the intestine, where they then go on to produce endotoxins, which leads to inflammation, edema, hemorrhage, necrosis, ulceration, and ultimately sometimes perforation. Really, any bacteria can be associated with neutropenic enterocolitis, but even fungi and viruses also are associated with neutropenic enterocolitis. So it is actually the most common gastrointestinal complication of patients with neutropenia. A nice systematic review looking at all adults hospitalized for the treatment of hematological malignancies or receiving high-dose chemotherapy, about 5% roughly of patients will develop neutropenic enterocolitis. So it is something we see often in our practice. The classic triad for neutropenic enterocolitis is a patient with fever, abdominal pain, neutropenia. However, that triad is only present in about 75% of patients. So as many as about 15% of patients won't even have a fever. And because of their immunocompromised status, about 12% won't even have abdominal pain, or it'll be extremely mild. And then neutropenia, there's grades of neutropenia, as I mentioned earlier. And so it's not always, it can sometimes be people in very mild neutropenia, just under 1,500 absolute neutrophils. And so that can be variable as well. They can also present, you know, much more extreme, as mentioned earlier, with bowel perforation, fistulas, GI hemorrhage, obstructions, or even intra-abdominal abscesses. So there are some several authors who have put together major and minor criteria for the diagnosis of neutropenic enterocolitis. It can be made clinically. There's also pathologic criteria that's been established for the histological confirmation of neutropenic enterocolitis. Radiographically also is our most important help to make the diagnosis. Almost always involves the cecum on the right side of the colon and the terminal ileum, but it can involve other parts of the bowel as well. And typically on radiology, what you're looking for is about a 4 millimeter diffuse or thickening of the bowel for at least 30 millimeters is kind of the radiographic criteria consistent with neutropenic enterocolitis. And so here's just a scan just showing you, you know, diffuse small bowel, or that's the cecum there, and small bowel wall thickening. You can also have contained perforation. So here the bowel isn't that diffusely thickened, but they have a contained perforation. And some patients will have pneumatosis intestinalis. This is a patient with CMV enterocolitis who had diffuse small bowel pneumatosis intestinalis and unfortunately dead bowel. So now I'd like to talk a little bit about the management outcome of these patients. So as you've heard, it's extremely controversial, and that's really because there's just a lack of high-quality evidence. These are hard patients to study, and there's such a heterogeneous presentation of cancer patients and where they are in their course of cancer and how sick they are. And so really, because there's lack of quality evidence, there's really no standard guidelines. And so, as mentioned before by previous speakers, really, you know, it's really individualized and based on the same things that people have talked about. You know, the clinical condition of the patient, you know, their, I think, as I mentioned earlier, you know, talking with their oncologist and really understanding where they are. It's very different. Someone who's just newly diagnosed, just started neoadjuvant chemotherapy for a very resectable tumor, is very different than someone who's stage four and on phase one studies, you know, kind of into their life. And so you have to take that into consideration. Also, the etiology of the abdominal pain really does drive, you know, if it's an appendectomy, appendicitis, that's very something that you can fix surgically. If it's diffuse small bowel necrosis and involvement, that's something that's not fixable. And then obviously the goals and wishes of the patient and family and kind of where they are in their processing of the patient's course. And so, you know, I put these up here as just kind of relative indications. I don't think there's any absolute indications or even contraindications. But medical management, you know, people who are hemodynamically stable, certainly you have time, so you can certainly start off with medical management. People who have little or no further oncologic treatments, medical management is probably, at the end of their life, is probably best. And, you know, 6 months is kind of a rough cutoff, but you just get an idea from the medical oncologist and also the patient, you know, kind of where we are in their course. As mentioned earlier, you know, people with significant impaired nutrition with the low albumins, the sarcopenia, there's multiple different ways to look at nutritional status, but that's something that you do have to take in consideration, and as well as functional status. And then, you know, significant comorbidities come into play too. I mean, you've already have one hit with the neutropenia, and now if you have other hits where they're in chronic kidney disease and they have all kinds of other things, this may not even be a survivable situation regardless of what you do. And then for surgery, I mean, we just talked about new peritoneum, so I won't belabor that. Certainly, these are signs and symptoms that patients are probably not going to do well with medical therapy. Doesn't mean you have to take them to surgery, but it just means that they're probably not going to do well with medical therapy. And so if you are in the situation where you're hoping to get them through this, you're probably going to need surgery. And so these are kind of relative indications, at least to think about peritonitis, septic shock, people with uncontrolled hemorrhage after reversing any anticoagulations. Obviously people fail medical management. And as I talked about earlier, I think if they have a straightforward, you know, appendicitis or cholecystitis or other thing, you manage that kind of those pathways that was discussed. And so that would be another indication potentially for surgery. And then again, if this is someone who, you know, just became neutropenic and you just saw them on day seven of their after a chemo and they're just at their nadir and they're going to recover quickly and they're otherwise doing really well, then that's someone, you know, you want to be a little more aggressive with. So what is medical management? We talk about that. For, you know, neutropenic enterocolitis, you know, it's aggressive IV fluid resuscitation, broad spectrum antimicrobials, bowel rest, NG decompression. Sometimes these people need TPN for support. They're already hypoalbuminuric. GM-CSF, it helped try to recover the neutrophil count. Then aggressive correction of either cytopenias and coagulopathies. And really, surgical intervention really isn't, you know, medical management or surgical intervention. It really is surgical intervention plus medical management. So you need to do all those things first and then decide if you're going to go to surgery or not. And so we do have some guidelines, at least from the medical management standpoint. So the Infectious Disease Society of America has given us some guidelines for what the optimal medications are, antimicrobials are for neutropenic fever is really where it comes from, but neutropenic enterocolitis. And basically, for monotherapy, it's basically piperacillin tazobactam or imipenem. And then if it's dual therapy, it can be a third-generation cephalosporin and a metronidazole. The ASCO also has guidelines for the use of GM-CSF, and essentially, they say if it's complicated neutropenic fever, which basically if they have neutropenic enterocolitis, that's complicated. And so these all patients should get 5 micrograms per kilogram of GM-CSF per day, and they can titrate it up. So this is something you can work with your medical oncologist about starting this early. And then the NCCN does have some guidelines for the treatment of febrile neutropenia. And so essentially you can stop your therapy once the neutrophil count recovers and their symptoms resolve. They don't need extended antibiotic coverage. And after about, they recommend 3 to 4 days of failure to progress, you can add antifungals and broaden your coverage. And so I think initially, you know, there were really poor outcomes with medical management, and so surgery was, I think, used a lot more aggressively initially. But now with the advancements that we've made in critical care and supportive care of these patients, actually we were able to get a lot more patients through this disease state. Non-operatively, and so surgery is really only reserved for the really, really sick patients, and I think that's kind of what we see in some of these survival curves when you compare surgery and no surgery. It's really the selection criteria of who's actually getting the operation versus who's able to manage medically. And so we do it. There is a NISQIP study looking at, you know, and unfortunately they don't have neutropenia, but they have leukopenia and NISQIP, and so using that as a surrogate, you know, patients with leukopenia undergo emergency surgery. You know, the mortality in those, that study is around 25%, and that's 30 days, and about 45% morbidity. So, as mentioned earlier, it is a significant morbidity and mortality with these patients. Prognostic factors, in addition to the neutropenia, to look at are again the depth and the degree of neutropenia. Not all neutropenia is the same. So patients have less; their undetectable neutrophil counts. That's a different patient than someone that's just hovering around 1,200 or 1,300. And then, you know, if they're bone marrow transplant and they're expecting weeks to months of neutropenia, that's very different than someone who's just at their nadir of last cycle of chemo and it's going to bounce back quickly. Obviously, you know, multi-organ dysfunction, if they're already in that, then that predicts poor survival no matter what you do. And obviously, advanced age, poor nutrition, significant medical comorbidities. These all fall out in the multivariate analysis of that NISQIP study as other significant prognostic factors. So you really have to individualize the patients you take to the operating room. And therefore, you know, in conclusion, you know, surgical consultation has got to be expeditious. It's got to begin with aggressive medical management initially. And then, as mentioned before, really involving the treating oncologist, the patient, the family, to get a real good understanding, especially if it's the first time meeting the patient, of where they are in their treatment and in their processing of their condition. If possible, you know, delaying surgical intervention until neutrophil count recover is ideal, but that's not always possible. So, you know, we kind of went over this a little bit, but additional indications or looking at indications for surgery. So this is a study that Dr. Bajwal published about 10 years ago now, looking at about 6 years of indications for abdominal pain in their cancer patients, neutropenic cancer patients. And you can see here, they really only operate on 6 or 7 patients over that decade. So most patients can be managed non-operatively. And you can see here, what I think I learned the most from this was just the delay in diagnosis. So most of the people that go on to surgery, we waited till they recovered their neutrophil counts. And then, as you see, they were normal by the time they actually had the operation and then did it. And those were the people who typically had the best outcomes on the right. And again, you know, some straightforward things that are fixable surgically, like splenic rupture, cholecystitis, appendicitis. Those are the kind of patients I think most commonly. And then, you know, less commonly, neutropenic enterocolitis or bowel obstruction in the setting of neutropenia. And then lastly, I just want to talk a little about, you know, general surgical principles in a patient who is neutropenic at the time of operation. You know, if they're truly neutropenic and profound drainage of necrotic or infection is really not going to, probably not going to be sufficient. They don't have an immune system to wall off to, you know, to fight the infection. So you really, if you're going to do an operation, you need to resect that perforated bowel, that necrotic area, or whatever the you're dealing with. Obviously, these patients don't heal anastomosis well, so doing diversions is ideal. Sometimes if the primary tumor is massive or if you're having proximal obstructions, maybe bypassing might be the better part of valor. you just have to take into account their immunocompromised state and surgery. So here's kind of an algorithm for looking at these patients, which is essentially kind of what people have discussed before. Just really understanding where they are With the CT scan, you know, what's the underlying problem of their abdominal pain, how neutropenic they are, and then deciding, is it something appendicitis, diverticulitis, cholecystitis, we're going to go down that management pathway, or is this neutropenic enterocolitis? And so if it's neutropenic enterocolitis, then deciding, you know, is this the patient who could do well with medical therapy? Are they not that sick? Or are they so sick that they shouldn't go to the operating room? And this is the end of a terminal condition. Or is this someone that you could rescue and return the intended oncological therapy, and someone you could salvage? And so that's kind of that individualized decision making. And then whenever possible, delaying surgery if you can until the neutropenia recovers. So in conclusions, the differential diagnosis for pain, abdominal pain, in neutropenic patient is broad. We talked a little about the pathogenesis involving translocation of bacteria and inflammation. This is not an uncommon problem. About 5% of hospitalized cancer patients receiving chemotherapy. We talked about the clinical triad of clinical presentation. However, only 3/4 of patients will present with all three. We talked a little bit about how CT scans are the most valuable in identifying or diagnosing patients with neutropenic enterocolitis. And lastly, we touched a little bit about how management and outcomes really are individualized to the individual patient. Thanks.